Continuation of interview of Jacob Davis, mini assessment interviewer.
I think I've talked enough about Mildred. I'd add only this. That ours was a very happy marriage, and I can't say too much in praise of a great lady. Because Mildred was a great lady. She had a splendid intellect. And she was a person of infinite grace and infinite dignity. And her presence was felt wherever she was. And now I think enough of Mildred, because what I feel inside myself should not interest anybody else, but should remain in my heart.
There is just one thing, though, Jake, that I'd like to know. Have you continued some of the same interests in art and the areas to which she opened your vision and your attitudes?
Yes, that, of course.
Have you done any purchasing since Mildred's death?
Yes, there have been a number of things that I've purchased, but all along the line of our own inquiry, I can't for the moment think, yes, there's a painting right in front of me that I purchased after Mildred died. There are several sculptures in the front room which I purchased after she died, one of which she had seen. Remember that she began to ail about a year before her death, and it was only when the metastasis broke off and hit someplace in her head that there was no communication because she couldn't speak, that was the end. But the same paths which we had explored together did not deteriorate. They still were beautiful paths. Not because we had pursued them together, but because they were beautiful. They stood the test of time. And this home in which you are sitting is a sample or an epitome of what we learned together. Now, there are much more sumptuous homes in the city than this one, but I doubt if there's any home in which more loving care had been put into the purchase of particular paintings, not for any other reason except that we loved them and because they had to be beautiful. I think it's a mistake to say that people buy paintings because they love them. That's not a good reason. Painting should be a great painting. It should have some idea of projection into the future. It should explore new paths or re-explore old paths. And here's a girl whom I've already described, who came from simple people, who rebelled against the overpiety of her home, who became fantastically rich. She used to have her own driver and her own horse and buggy, and then later on had to worry whether she would spend 5 cents on the subway or not. That was when everything went black in the break of the market. But, yes?
Jack, you talk about the break of the market. You lived through those periods, too. You've lived for your 77 years of age, so you've lived through tremendous changes and developments in the world. For instance, let's take the various wars through which you have lived. It started, what, with the Mexican War?
Well,
1915? And going on through.
I was aware of the Mexican War, but I was much too young to be anything more than aware of it. I knew that Black Jack Pershing went down into Mexico after Pancho Villa, but that was about all. The First World War, of course, I was aware of. Because some of the boys that I knew, or men that I knew, were off to war. Well, luckily, as you know, it didn't last very long. That is, the American involvement didn't last very long. and there was no severe bloodletting of the American young manhood in that war.
But did it change your attitudes? I mean, did you begin to think more globally or at that time because of World War I?
I don't think so, Minnie. Because remember, how old could I have been at that time?
When you were in college.
When the war was over, I was 21 years old. Remember, a 21-year-older at that time was much less sophisticated than a 21-year-older now. You had your work to do, and particularly, you had your work to do if you had to help support the family. And I want to underline the word family there because I want to come back to that. When the boys come home from the war, I can remember the Feldstein boy who was killed. I remember the parades when the boys marched up and down Fifth Avenue holding a big flag and everybody would throw silver coins or whatever coins there were. And a big hurrah. My brother Max, for instance, went off to Camp Lee. He was to become a commissioned officer. Well, he was just about to be graduated as a commissioned officer when the war was over. Well, he was glad to get out as everybody else was glad to get out. I still have Max's picture in the office as one of a group at Camp Lee, but Max never did get his commission. What else can I say about
that?
Well,
do you think World War I and the experiences then affected life during the 20s? Did it have any kind of influence?
That's different. When you talk about the 20s, then things began to change completely. Because suddenly there was a rise of affluence. There was an enormous influx of wealth. How it came about, I don't know. Must have been a great flow of money. And everybody suddenly became money conscious. Everybody wanted to get rich. The economy stepped up and up and up, and it looked as though there was no end. Now, if you want a picture of that time, it's better not to interview me, but to read the books of Scott Fitzgerald, who was the typical writer of that era, the writer of the destruction of the bright young man by the overpowering wealth of great wealth. Or read my book, read the book of my friend and roommate Mal Cowley, who talks about the expatriates in Paris, who ran away from this and lived in Paris, and then eventually came back because they were disillusioned by Paris and came back in time to be wiped out in the Depression. What was a Depression? There was a stock market craze. Everybody bought stock on margin. At that time, one could buy stock by borrowing money at the bank and paying 10% down and carrying a margin of 90%. Well, today, an adult man, first of all, can't do it because the regulations don't permit it. But second of all, anybody with any sense, he said, would know that he couldn't operate on a 10% margin. I tried it, along with many other people. And as it happened, I picked a loser. And I don't know how many years it took me to pay off the bank, but of course I paid off. In due course, and vowed and declared I would never buy anything on margin again, and I did not. At the same time, there was the rise of bootlegging in America, which provided a vast amount of wealth for a certain chosen few, among whom were some of our nicest, the sons of our nice Jewish families, who became fantastically rich, who had bundles and bundles and bundles of money hidden away with no good way of hiding it. But I think we're wandering pretty far afield. Eventually, all of these fellas, with few exceptions, lost out. I can remember walking, I can remember riding towards Atlanta, Georgia. I was making a trip to Atlanta on business, and I'd had my breakfast in the dining car, and by mistake, instead of walking forward to where my berth was, I walked backwards, and I walked into a car where there were a lot of men lined up all on one side of the aisle. And I saw a boy there. Boy, he wasn't a boy. He was a man. I was a man. We were both in our 20s. Whom I knew when we used to go to cheder And I went over to him and I said, Sam, what the hell are you doing here? Oh, he says, I'm on a little trip with these fellows. And I shook my head and turned around and walked back to my own car and asked the porter, who are those fellows back there? And the porter said to me, well, they're on their way to Leavenworth. Mm-hmm. Sam was one of the, I could give his last name, but what's the point? He's dead and gone. He was on his way to Leavenworth. He was caught. More adept men were not caught. But suddenly there was a lot of money in the community. A lot of people made a lot of money. And wealth was all over the place.
I wanted to ask this, Jake. Was there a feeling of violating the law? I mean, was there a moral attitude about violating the prohibition law?
It was an ambivalence. Nobody liked the Volstead Act because this was a kind of Puritanism which was too much even for the puritanical American to swallow. But the law was, after all, the law. And if you wanted any kind of alcoholic beverage, you had to break the law to get it. Now, breaking the law was not frowned on if you wanted, that is, unless you broke the law to make money. But if you wanted a drink, you managed to have the police officer on the beat bring you in a case of scotch or a case of bourbon or whatever it was. Or you found somebody who could sell you pure alcohol and you made your own liquor. And some of the vile stuff that we drank at that time is horrible to contemplate in retrospect. It's a wonder that any of us have any digestive systems left. But that was the code of the time. It was a common thing to get drunk in a polite kind of way. That is, you took time, you set out deliberately to get a little bit plastered. Not really violently drunk. What was looked down on were these. Number one, the man who was in the business of bootlegging for money. And number two, the fellow who got away with it. The fellow that didn't get away with it, you felt sorry for. The fellow that did get away with it, you hated his guts.
You mean that? Well, why?
Well, because he had a lot of money and you didn't.
Oh, was it that? It wasn't a matter based upon legalistic or moralistic.
No,
attitudes.
Because the morals, the whole feeling of the whole country was against the Volstead Act. Nobody liked the Volstead Act. And as soon as there was a chance to... Now, wait a minute, I'm talking the wrong kind of times. Because the Volstead Act wasn't repealed until the 1930s.
Yeah.
But it went on and during the 20s, and there was an enormous fortunes made. I know of a boy that I used to idolize. He used to play basketball at the Zionist Council. Great, tall, handsome guy. Well, the story was that he had $1,800,000 cash in a safety deposit box, and I think he did. But he died flat broke.
This comes to mind, you know, that during World War II, there was the black market, and the people who made money and put their money in safety deposit vaults, and I presume some of them to Switzerland. Would you say that there was the same kind of feeling about them as there was about people who broke the law or violated the law in prohibition times?
I think it was a totally different thing. Well, first, remember, I was young. Second, the only law that one countenanced being broken was the prohibition law. Other laws you didn't break. Now, I'm sure that the general morality was about the same. But if a man broke the prohibition law, you didn't look down your nose at him.
What about those who black marketed in World War II?
World War II is a different thing, and I think we ought to wait to get on to that because
okay. We're
going to go very far afield.
All right. Now, then came the Depression.
Then came the Depression. Well, if you're going chronologically, that's one thing. I didn't think that we would go along that way, but
I'm talking in terms of how it affected you and how you felt about it.
Well, the bottom dropped out of everything. The bottom dropped out of everything. for two reasons. First, for very bad planning on the national level, and second, a very bad banking system. It started with a failure of the Dresdner Bank in Dresden, and that failure of that German bank spread all over the world until I don't think there was a country in the whole world that wasn't affected, and America was affected worst.
How did it affect you?
Well, just this, because we were lucky enough not to owe a great deal of money at that time. Matter of fact, we owed very little. And we had many assets, including much real estate, which was free and clear of all encumbrance. But the difficulty was that when one went to borrow money on that real estate, you couldn't get anybody to give you a mortgage, because the few banks that had money wouldn't lend money on a mortgage. Or if it was on a mortgage, it had to be a very, very prime real estate at a very high rate and so on. At any rate, the bottom dropped out of everybody, out of everybody's life. That was the time when the unemployment soared to 12%, and I think at a more accurate account than kept, it would have been higher even than that. It was the time when there were men on the street, able-bodied, honorable, decent men that wanted to work and couldn't find any work no matter what. You'd see these fellas on the street selling apples at 10 cents a piece, and it was heartbreaking. You buy an apple whether you wanted a damn thing or not, because you had 10 cents and he needed the 10 cents. And confidential, you stuck the apple in your pocket and you eventually ate it. How did it affect me? Well, I can tell you this story, that the jewelry business simply went to pot. Jewelry business and diamonds. Who needed diamonds and who needed jewelry? Our volume dropped 90%. Now, don't make any mistake about this. It didn't drop 10% to be 90% of what it had been. It dropped 90% so that it was 10% of what it was. So there was no earthly way in the world to come out even. I remember talking to my brother Maurice and saying to him, look, Mache, we can't make it. Nobody can make it. The best thing for us to do is just to sit still, collect what money we have out, try to live on it, keep the boss alive, keep ourselves alive, and try to ride this thing out. We didn't want to buy. We didn't want to sell. Our customers didn't want to pay their accounts because they couldn't pay their accounts. And many of them, of course, seized that opportunity of not paying their accounts simply by reason of going bankrupt. It was a very fashionable thing to go bankrupt. Some of the best names in the jewelry business had gone bankrupt. But there's others that didn't. They took forever and ever and ever to pay, but eventually they paid off. I can remember buying an overcoat. I went to McKeesport to buy it. It cost $10. Now, at no time could one buy a decent overcoat for $10. But such as it was, I bought it. And I wore that overcoat for 4 years. Now, this is the extent to which the Depression had hit. Now, I'm not trying to give a sociological talk.
No, but I'm talking only about how it affected you.
Of people who have been used to living comfortably and decently, having to worry about where does the next dollar come from, where you're going to have money not to pay the rent, because we didn't have to pay rent. We owned our home. But where are you going to get money to pay the help? And you had to pay your help. You had to pay them something.
Well, did you have a feeling of desperation, or was there a feeling of hope that eventually, because of your feeling about our country and its leadership?
No,
what was your politics?
I never had
your
a sense of desperation. One was young enough still to be resilient and to feel that some or another, something was going to turn up.
How'd you about your parents?
Well, parents, father had been dead for a long, long, long time. And mother was very wise. I remember walking up and down in the living room at her home on Albemarle Street and hearing her say to me, "Why don't you get out of the house and stop this walking up and down the living room? Why don't you go out and go to a movie?" And my answer was, "Mother, if I had the money, I'd go to a movie, but I don't have the money." She said, "I'll give you the money." Well, I'd just given the money to her. So she gave me enough money to get out of the house and go to a movie. And it was that one lived from day to day. Well, eventually, of course, there was the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his rousing speeches, where you have nothing to fear except fear, which was well enough said, and the first beginnings of the Public Works Associate Administration, the PWA, which was a complete boondoggle, and then the WPA, which was less a boondoggle. But one struggled through, and it wasn't really until about 1938 that the country began to right itself, and there was a chance of some vision. Now, that does not mean, by any matter of means, that there weren't some men that didn't do extremely well, men that had kept themselves sufficiently liquid that they could either buy long or sell short. That was the time when Joe Kennedy became one of the richest men in America. He sold short all over the place. Other men bought. They bought shares of stock at $1 a share, which was not even a fraction of the assets of the company. And eventually, when hope came up in the public spirit, and these shares increased, and the earnings of the companies increased, the shares increased, and people made fantastic fortunes. And aside from these spectacular gains or losses, or short sellings or long sellings, the simple day-by-day putting one brick onto another and building a wall or building a building went on, and people did manage to achieve something. The apple sellers disappeared from the street. There were jobs. There were homes built. Now, I don't think that it's my job to try to deliver an economic
lecture.
No,
I'm not talking only in terms of its effect upon you. Did you change your attitudes about politics at any time? Did you change your party affiliation?
No, I didn't change my party affiliation because I was just too lazy or too unlucky.
But had you been registered?
I had been registered Republican because my father said never become a Democrat because the Democrats put on the panic of 1893, I think it was. So I became a Republican. I never voted along party lines. And several times in my life I've wanted to change my party affiliation, but I always managed to get that urge at a time when it wasn't legal to do so, too close to an election. And I finally decided, what's the difference? I'll remain a Republican, but when the votes are counted, I shall vote as I please, and I've always voted independently. Now, there was another question you asked along about the idea of politics. Did it change my politics? Not really.
Well, you talked with such admiration about Franklin Roosevelt and his approach. This is why I meant in terms of changing your politics or perhaps political philosophy.
I didn't have any political philosophy, and I don't think most young men had political philosophy. Life was much too grim, many. One didn't have time to sit off in an ivory tower and think philosophically about the politics of the country. One had to make a living. This was a very real thing. If you had an old mother that couldn't get around, and she had been used to riding in an automobile with a driver, which was a rank luxury at the time, of course. Well, one was not apt to say, look, boss, you have to do without a car and a chauffeur. So one just plugged along and walked around with a buck and a half in his pocket and paid the chauffeur and paid the help at home because mother couldn't take care of running the home.
Would you say that same thing is true today?
No. I wouldn't say that, although I haven't thought.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the whole sense of values is different, and I want to reach that in a minute. But I don't think that the young men at that time had any philosophical approach to their problems. Philosophy is fine for those that can afford it. And sociological studies are fine for the university people. But the man that has to meet the payroll has to meet the payroll. And that's a very real business. Now, I'm not trying to puff out of any proportion. The man who boasts that he is not a payroll, whereas the abstract thinker doesn't know what it's all about, I don't agree with that at all. But when one is faced with the ultimate realities of keeping the ship on even keel, then you're faced with those realities. If you need a pair of socks, you need a pair of socks. And you have to have money to buy them. And philosophies, I don't know. At least I didn't have any. I kept subscribing to reading the New Republic and reading The Nation and reading the various liberal journals or intellectual journals. Maybe I should have learned something from them, but I didn't. And
you mean you read them without agreeing with their...
One read them, but they were remote. You were always faced with this grinding business that you had a bill to pay. And one didn't default on one's bills. And it wasn't until really 1938, 1939 that you began to see daylight, where you could see there was a chance of expansion, there was a chance of making some kind of move where there was hope that you were building something. And then, of course, when the war broke out, all the rules were off.
Let's get to World War II. And since we're approaching it in 1938, you talked about, I began to see daylight. Was this because of yourself feeling a turn in national and international attitudes, or because the war machine had started to turn?
Well, that's hard to say. I know that what happened in America also happened in Europe, because our dear friend Frank Raymakers came to America and it happened I was in New York. If I hadn't been there, David would have been there, and he would have looked David up. David is my own.
No, I mean Fred Raymakers.
Frank Raymakers was the head of our European office, and he had certain merchandise. He said, here, go ahead and buy it. And I said, with what? He said, don't worry with what. Buy it and go out and sell it and pay us when you can get good and ready. So you see, in Europe, too, they were looking for an expansion. They had been hurt very badly. And this is the way business works. Business doesn't work by your fits and jerks. It doesn't, it isn't arranged because somebody has a brilliant idea. Even the fantastic successes of modern time, like Xerox, took God knows how many years to incubate and to be developed and eventually come into fruition. So just as that is true about a fantastic success story like Xerox, it was also true of small business, growing the influences of Belgium on America, America on Belgium. They were looking to make a living, we were looking to make a living. And since the office in Antwerp knew that we would never default on our payments, they said, go ahead and take the merchandise and go out and sell it, and eventually you'll pay for it. Well, that was the beginning.
In the 30s, had you begun feeling, other than a Jewish reaction, to what Hitler was doing in Germany and on the continent?
This is something quite different. quite different. You must remember that the diamond business is largely run by Jews, so that in the markets in Belgium and even in New York, you were dealing with Jews and you were dealing with friendly people, and the business of Jew and non-Jew never came up. It was all Jews. With your customers, it depended what kind of man you were. I think I already have spoken that in all of my years of traveling, there was only one man, a customer of mine in Louisville, Kentucky, with whom I had a fallout, and that was because he spoke in high praise of Hitler, and that was enough for me. I walked out and never called him a man again, much to the disgust of the business and much to the disgust of my brothers, because he was a good customer. But I wouldn't deal with a man that had any admiration for Hitler.
All right, but you were dealing with a Jewish businessman in Europe in the 30s. Had they begun to be affected or frightened or concerned with the Hitler era?
I don't think so. They were in a generic kind of way, in a general kind of way. By which I mean this. The fact that one was in the diamond business, one had portable wealth. Now, when things began to look bad in Germany, the Belgians and the Dutch did not run away. They stayed. In the meantime, they had shifted most of their wealth out of the country and left only the smallest remnants behind with which to do business, and they did business from hand to mouth, just enough to keep navigating or to keep going. But I can illustrate what happened with this story. A very good friend of mine, Ezekiel Slyper, who was a Dutchman whose family had been diamond cutters, as he then said, for 300 years, which I question, but at all odds had been diamond cutters for a long, long time, had moved from Amsterdam to Antwerp because Antwerp had become the market beginning in 1929, really began in 1926. Zeich kept in the office all kinds of currency, had American currency, and Belgian currency, and French currency, and English currency, and maybe some other kind of currency that I don't know of, but certainly those four. And there were little odds and ends of diamonds. Now, when the war broke out, which I think I told the story about being in the River Scheldt on September the 1st, 1939.
No, you didn't.
Oh, I must have told that.
No, mm-mm. I think it might be a good idea to tell it now.
Well, anyhow, let me finish with Ezekiel Slyper so I won't destroy the continuity. Zeph went to the safe and he picked various currencies, and he and Rachel, his wife, by the way, Rachel is a member of a famous family. Her brother was the great Abraham Asher, A-S-C-H-E-R, who cut the Cullinan diamond for the crown of England. Zeich picked up this money, these little tail ends of very bad quality diamonds, and started going south out of Belgium. They managed to keep ahead of the German army, and when they came to a frontier, everything was, in confusion. They got across the frontier. They were on their way to Portugal. And they got across the frontiers not by reason of the money, because the frontier guards were afraid to take money. They didn't want to get caught with the currency, especially foreign currency. But a few diamonds they could secrete, and what did they know whether the diamonds were good diamonds or bad diamonds? And Zach used to laugh how he purchased his freedom with a bare minimum out of the worst possible kind of diamonds, which was a joke between the two of us. I thought I told about being in Europe. I went to Europe on the Ile-de-France. I landed in Paris in 1939. I know I was there on Assumption Day, which I think is August the 15th or August the 14th, I don't know which. And when I landed there, I found the whole city closed up because of it being a holiday, a religious holiday, which disgusted me no end. I had nothing to do. So I went to the perfume shop where I usually did business and bought, as I recall, a whole bunch of perfume, which I had to bring back to various members of the family and so on. I never did get that perfume, as the story will subsequently develop, although I paid for it. And later, when I got back to see the owner of the shop, who had been a prisoner of war in Germany, I said to him, "You know, you owe me so many dollars in perfume." And he said, "Forget about it. We've washed that slate clean. I haven't got the money, I haven't got the perfume. Let's start over again." Anyhow, from Paris, I went to Amsterdam, where I did whatever buying I could. I remember sitting on the terrace at the Amstel Hotel. I was reading a book. You'll recognize the name. It was The Days of Our Years by Pierre van Bassen. And there were some people sitting behind me, people named Jolis, J-O-L-I-S, members of a very rich and powerful family. And Carol, Jewish by birth, but that's all. Carl had a very vile sense of humor, because as I was reading my book, and the waiter was serving me, the waiter suddenly handed me a note saying, "Be careful, you are being watched." Well, that scared the liver out of me. It was a fine thing, knowing what I did know about what was going on. I sat quietly and finished my dinner. I don't know how I did. I certainly didn't digest it very well. And then turned around and saw Carl and Mrs. Carl sitting there laughing their heads off. Well, there was nothing for me to do except to take this rotten joke as a joke and went back and smiled with them and so on. I landed in Antwerp the next day and immediately began to buy right and left because I had the feeling that the war was coming on. As a matter of fact, I kept wondering, in God's name, why did I ever take this trip? You had to be insane to take the trip. But my children were taken care of by my mother, and I was free, and why not? Put it down for stupidity or whatever you want. A cautious person wouldn't have taken the trip. I began to buy everything I could get my hands on. And I remember that on Friday, I had out a great many seals. The seals mean that I sealed up certain parcels of diamonds. And according to the rules of the exchanges, nobody could open those seals but I.
Excuse me, Jake, out of ignorance. You said you bought freely, but you didn't carry the stuff with you. It was to be shipped. Is that it? Is that what you're talking about, the seals?
Correct. No, the seals was first. If one is asked a certain price for diamonds, one knows almost without exception that one is being over-asked. So you make a counter-offer. And then final negotiations come the next day. Well, the next day was a Saturday. In those days, we used to work on Saturday. And I came to the office, and so help me, there wasn't even so much as a cockroach in the office. Not one of the brokers had shown up. Nobody was there. And a boy named Louis Polk, whom I later found out was a Jew, came to me and said, "Mr. Davis, there's a freight boat leaving from the foot of the mayor today at 12 o'clock, and he mentioned another man's name. This man has reserved a place for you on that freight boat." Well, then it was up to me to decide what to do. Did I want to stay and try to make some money, or did I want to get home? And it didn't take me long to come to a conclusion. Now, this is a silly question to ask. The best I can do is to stay here and get some merchandise and either carry it in my pocket or ship it by mail. And in those days, the mail was inviolate, or else I can save my skin, because if these fellows get a hold of me, if these Germans get a hold of me. Now, why do I say these Germans? Because this was Saturday morning, and Friday night, I was out with a friend of mine, and already there was mobilization of the Belgian army. So I knew that there was something very bad brewing. When I heard there was a chance to get out, I said, look, I want to get out of here. Not that I felt any personal danger, not that I was a coward, but it just didn't make any sense of staying there, running the chance of being interned for 4 years, 5 years, 1 year, who know what. So I landed on a freight boat. Now, I could tell you a whole long, fascinating story of how I landed on a freight boat and became the second supercargo. Now, can you imagine that? And how I traveled in a boat that was originally designed to carry Percheron horses. And how I lived among so many bugs, you can't imagine. And I don't mean little tiny bugs, but bugs big enough that they seemed like sea serpents. But one lived through that. And I sat at the captain's table, if you don't mind. Captain Perret was the captain's name, a man that had the most violent cross eyes I ever saw in my life. One eye looked straight ahead, and the other eye looked almost at right angles. And he was a dictator. I'm spoiling my story. I'll have to tell you the story in private, but it doesn't belong on this tape. How very foolishly I sent the profligate son of a very rich family out to buy whiskey and cigarettes. If I'd only sent him out to buy oranges or apples, because cigarettes, there was whiskey, there was plenty on the boat. Cigarettes is a long story, how I lost my cigarettes, and they didn't show up until we landed in Hoboken. But the food on that ship was simply god-awful. And when I didn't eat, Captain Perret looked over to me and said, Mr. Davis, you're not eating. And I said, I'm sorry, Captain, I've lost my appetite today. Well, the truth of the matter is I didn't lose my appetite. We were sitting at the captain's table where we had to have fresh food. And it smelled to high heaven. Now, if I'd only been able to go back with the crew, where they had good tinned sardines and good tinned salmon and good tinned beans, which didn't smell to high heaven, but we had to eat fancy. After 6 days out, we had mule, M-O-U-L-E, which are little black shellfish. What do they call them?
Snails?
No,
mule
would
be something else.
It'll come to me in a minute. Anyhow, in Belgium we call them mule. Now, it's well known that you should meet mule after 1 day. And here we were out there 6 days out, and I looked at my friend Jack Slever and said, my God, if we eat those mule, we'll die. What are we going to do about it? And Jack answered me and said, we're going to eat the mole and die. But we didn't.